It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to a TV critic about the recent uptick in female-driven television shows and how the Me Too movement plays into this trend. First, we're learning more about what led to a deadly explosion following a natural gas leak in downtown Sun Prairie on July 10th. The explosion killed father and firefighter Corey Barr as he was responding to the broken gas main. Nearly a dozen others were injured and several buildings were destroyed. Now the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has found that the contractor that ruptured the natural gas pipe prior to the explosion was not registered to work in Wisconsin. Molly Beck is the Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been following this story. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're still learning more, but can you give us some background on what led to this explosion?
Sure. So on July 10th, as probably most of your listeners know, there was a huge explosion in Sun Prairie that pretty much leveled a city block in downtown portion of that suburb of Madison. And what we know is that there was a contractor working in the area laying some fiber optic lines below the street for a Verizon Wireless project. And I got a recording of the 911 call, and there's a worker that says, you know, we were doing construction work and we hit a gas line. It's really bad. And so I was looking at who the contractor was after Bear Communications, who was handling the project for Verizon, released the name of the contractor they were using for the project. And it's a company called BC Tech, and it's based in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And he's not the person that owns the company, is not registered to do business in Wisconsin. There is a law that requires businesses to be registered, but it does provide for exceptions in some instances. And the state officials I talked to couldn't say whether or not there was an exception for this business, but also said there's no enforcement mechanism to provide a penalty if you're not registered.
So this obviously was a horrible incident, made that much worse because of the death of Corey Barr. Are police saying anything about the possibility of bringing criminal charges? You talked about there not really being any enforcement for not being registered to do the work, but what about criminal issues?
Yeah. The police are deciding now whether there was criminal negligence involved here, and that the police have not decided whether or not anybody will be charged. But what they're probably looking at is whether, probably if anybody did this intentionally, but I think they're more looking at whether the workers took, you know, safety precautions that are required by law when you're doing that kind of work. For example, when you're digging underground, anybody who digs underground, including just regular homeowners, you're supposed to call the state diggers hotline and have the utility companies mark where there's utility lines, like a natural gas line, so you don't hit them when you're doing the digging. So if that didn't happen, that could be one element of what they're looking at. And so far, I've asked this question of, you know, We Energies, who owns the natural gas line, the police, the companies that were doing the digging. I've asked everybody whether or not these lines were located, you know, whether the location was identified for the worker, and nobody will say if it was or wasn't.
What else do we know, if anything, about VC Tech, whether either their presence previously in Wisconsin or in other states?
So all I know is that it's based in Michigan. It's owned by a man named Valentin Kokuba. I believe that's how you pronounce it. And he also was sued the same day of the explosion by a former worker. He was sued in Dane County, so it must have been for jobs in the area. And I spoke to that worker, and he said that he wasn't aware of the July 10th job because he had stopped working with the company by that point. He said he felt lucky that he wasn't working with the company at that point. And he's suing the company because he just stopped getting paid.
Do we know if any of the people who were injured in the explosion were employees of VC Tech?
You know, we don't know that. I know that there was a firefighter that was critically injured initially, and I believe he's doing much better now. And there were 10 others who were injured, but all of them, I believe, are are out of the hospital. I don't believe anybody's still in the hospital at this point. But I don't know if any of them were workers with BCSEC.
We're talking with Molly Beck right now. She's Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about new information that the Journal Sentinel uncovered that the subcontractor who most likely caused the explosion in Sun Prairie last week was not registered to work in Wisconsin. And Molly, as we mentioned before, there was an evacuation effort. I believe that Corey Barr actually was responding to help with that. He wasn't actually summoned as a volunteer firefighter, but he wanted to go help evacuate the area and then lost his life. Are we able to speculate if lives were saved with those evacuation efforts?
Yeah, I think we can absolutely assume that because the firefighters and the police department right after this happened, when they met with reporters, they said that there was about a 40-minute window between when the gas line was hit and when the explosion happened. And in that time, firefighters like Corey Barr were in the area helping get everybody out of the businesses that were there, including Corey Barr's own tavern, the Bar House, and the Glass Nickel. And I'm not sure what other businesses are right there, but they were evacuating almost 100 people. So if that hadn't happened, it could have been a lot worse.
And as we said, firefighter and business owner Corey Barr was killed in the explosion. How is he being remembered in Sun Prairie?
He had a funeral service last weekend, and I believe almost 3,000 people came to that, and to the public one that invited the Sun Prairie community. I know that dozens of fire departments in the area are helping out Sun Prairie take care of their calls right now as they kind of deal with what's going on in the aftermath and just coping with what happened. Right after the explosion, we were covering that, and there was a great sense of community. There was a lot of people who came out to, you know, pay their respects and show support for the community. And I know that there's a lot of fundraising going on for Corey Barr's family. He was married and had two twin daughters who were 3 years old. And so there's, you know, I believe over $100,000, if not more than that, raised for them so far.
As you said, there was significant damage done to businesses there in downtown Sun Prairie, also roads and other infrastructure. Where are they at with trying to get life as back to normal as possible?
Yeah, I think we got a list of all the businesses that were damaged, and there were, I believe, I don't know, 6 to 10 businesses that were considered destroyed. And then, you know, a whole list of others that were in the zone that was considered to be, you know, we're not sure if it's safe to be, you know, back in these buildings or not. I think they're getting back. Some of the businesses have reopened, and some of the areas of downtown that had been marked off are open again. But I think that area right where the Bar House was, where the explosion, the worst of the explosion happened, is still closed.
And Molly, as this story continues to develop, and of course recovery will take a long time, what are you going to be watching for next as the story goes on?
I think we're most interested in knowing if those basic safety precautions were taken, if, you know, identifying where a natural gas line is before you start digging underground is pretty crucial and just a basic thing in a job like that. So we're waiting to see if that did take place or not.
And have the police given any indication when they might decide whether they will file those criminal charges or not?
Yeah, initially last week they said, earlier this week, they said that they were within days of making that decision. And then a couple days ago they said they were pushing back that timetable. They have more to look at. They weren't specific, but we're not sure exactly when that decision will be made.
Well, Molly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck is the Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was with us to talk about last week's explosion in downtown Sun Prairie and the news that the contractor who cut a natural gas line in the area wasn't registered to work in Wisconsin. For several years now, there's been a rise in popular television shows that feature female-driven stories and lead characters. And we're seeing a surge of women writing, directing, and producing TV shows and films in an entertainment industry that men have traditionally run. For more on this trend and how this is changing the TV landscape, we're joined by Jen Chaney, a pop culture writer and critic for Vulture. Jen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
There are so many shows to talk about. There are dramas like HBO's Big Little Lies and Sharp Objects. There's Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale. And there are also comedies like Amazon's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and AMC's Dietland. You know, so many of the biggest shows out right now are featuring these female-driven narratives and lead characters. How do you explain the rise in this kind of content?
Well, you mentioned Big Little Lies, which was a huge success for HBO about a year ago or so. And I think that has really helped kickstart what was already in the works, which is just more of an effort to have female voices on TV. There's still a lot more that can be done in that department, but I think that a lot of strides have been made simply because there's a recognition that a lot of women are hungry for this kind of storytelling. And frankly, because the TV landscape has gotten so large, there's just room for more kinds of stories to be told. You know, there's Hulu and Netflix and Amazon, and so many of them want original programming that, honestly, they'd be foolish not to have shows like this, and they've seen success with it. So once you have success, that's just going to breed more of the same.
And you said, Jen, that women are hungry for this kind of content, but is it just women? Are these shows getting wider viewership than maybe would have been expected a few years ago?
Oh, for sure. I don't mean to suggest that only women are watching some of these shows. I think Big Little Lies, again, was a show that had great appeal to both men and women. On the comedy side, a show like Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, I think, appeals to women as well as men. So certainly there's a wide audience for it. But in terms of, you know, as you said, seeing female characters who are really driving the stories, and oftentimes seeing women behind the scenes as well who are telling these stories, I think that's the real change.
Do you think that all of these shows are by definition feminist? Because some people have embraced that and some have kind of distanced themselves.
Right. Well, I mean, feminist at its most basic level is simply the idea that women should be considered equal to men, right? And so certainly I think the underlying notion of these shows is that women are equal to men. But I think you see something even more than that. And I actually wrote a piece about this at the beginning of the summer about how this was the summer of Me Too television, meaning that a lot of shows were really addressing a lot of the subjects that have come up as a result of the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement. And that, to me, is definitely feminist. I mean, what you see going on in a show like Dietland on AMC, where part of the show is about this vigilante group called the Jennifers, who are going after men who are perceived to have been abusive toward women.
Yeah, I'm kind of rooting for Jennifer. Is that a wrong thing?
Vigilantism is a slippery slope.
You are correct. They should really only do it two, maybe four more times. I got some names for them.
I mean, that is feminism to its maybe most extreme and not necessarily in line with some of the values in terms of the violence involved. But this idea of women rising up and sort of speaking out and wanting to be equal, I think that is very much at play in a lot of the shows we're talking about.
Jen, several of these shows deal with very difficult topics. One that comes to mind right away is The Handmaid's Tale. It's been criticized by some as torture porn, and looking at the horrific treatment of women in this dystopian future. There's also concern that's been raised about the show Sharp Objects, that it might glamorize self-harm while it's shedding a light on that issue. Where do you think the line is between brutally realistic or just plain brutal depictions
right.
of these issues?
Right. It's very tricky. And the line, I think, is different for everybody. I think one of the things that makes The Handmaid's Tale difficult is the fact that it seems reflective of certain things that are happening in the culture now. For example, in the second season, you know, just as this debate has been happening about the way we're handling immigrant families and separating children from their parents, there were episodes of The Handmaid's Tale that were debuting on Hulu where you specifically saw babies being taken away from their mothers.
How are you going to keep her safe? How are you going to keep her safe? What are you going to do? Are you going to lock her up here like an orchid?
My daughter will be raised properly.
That makes the horror of it that much more hard to watch, because it does feel real, quote unquote, in a sense. But I think there's just an element of, for me anyway, do I feel like what they're doing is organic to the storytelling? Is it necessary? And are they not getting gratuitous with it in terms of, you know, gore or violence or things like that? And with Sharper Objects, which you just mentioned, I feel like they have walked that line very, very carefully. It's hard for me to imagine somebody watching that show and wanting to emulate the behavior that Amy Adams' character is engaging with, but I don't think the show is condoning it. And in fact, HBO has put a disclaimer at the end of every episode suggesting this is where you can go, you know, for help if you have any of these issues. So I think it's, if you can sense that the creators are really trying to demonstrate a level of responsibility, for me that is certainly helpful.
We're talking with Jen Chaney. She's a pop culture writer and critic for Vulture. We're talking about how women and female characters are driving a lot of what we're seeing on TV these days. And Jen, it's interesting because there can be strong female protagonist roles that look very different from show to show. And so some are women who are basically just performing what would stereotypically be shown as masculine feats, you know, lots of, like, basically an action movie on TV and, you know, take out male hero, insert female hero. And then there are others where it's kind of giving women a different way to be a strong protagonist. What do you think it means that we are seeing women in both those types of roles?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, especially I think in the movies as well, for a long time, the notion of a strong female character was just a woman doing things that we typically see a man do, which, you know, there is something entertaining sometimes about watching, you know, a female superhero or what have you. But I think what's different now is that we're seeing women that are doing things on women's terms and really in female language. There's a show called Killing Eve that aired on BBC America, its first season, and it is in a lot of ways what you might think of as a typical quote-unquote male type of show, in that it's a cat-and-mouse thriller. You've got a serial killer, and you've got a person from MI5 trying to track her down. But it's two women, and the way that they communicate with each other, you know, the serial killer taunts her by sending her really beautiful clothes that fit her perfectly, and she uses perfume at certain times as a weapon. And that, to me, is very female kind of vocabulary around something that typically has been a male genre. And that's kind of pushing it in a further direction than we've seen before, I think.
I want to make sure we talk about some of the comedies that fit into this discussion, like Dietland, like Mrs. Maisel, and Netflix Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Humor can be difficult to use. It can be very effective to talk about difficult issues, but I think there are even more pitfalls than treating it in a dramatic sense. How effective have some of those shows been in handling serious issues?
Dietland is probably the trickiest one because it dances between genres so much that I would almost hesitate to call it a comedy, even though oftentimes it is comedic. I think Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and certainly Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt are a little more straightforward in the way that they use comedy. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is about a woman who becomes a stand-up comedian and sort of an outrageous stand-up comedian in the 1950s at a time when it was really, really unusual for a woman to do that. And so, you know, comedy is what really empowers her.
So my life completely fell apart today. Did I mention that my husband left me?
Woohoo!
Okay. All right, but did I mention that he left me for his secretary? Mm-hmm. She's 21 and dumb as a Brillo pad. And I'm not naive. I was a great wife. I was fun. I planned theme nights. I dressed in costumes. I gave him kids, a boy and a girl. And yes, our little girl is looking more and more like Winston Churchill every day, you know, with a big Yalta head. But that's not a reason to leave, right?
And so I think that's a really great use of comedy. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, I think, has done something especially tricky because, you know, that's a show whose premise is basically like a Lifetime movie. This is a woman who was kidnapped and held captive by an awful man for many, many years and is finally released from her prison and then goes to New York and has been so out of the loop on society that she doesn't really know how to react to everything.
What in the ham sandwich? I just got a job.
Please tell me that you're normal. I need someone here to talk to.
Oh, I'm very normal. I've had everything normal happen to me.
So it's sort of this mix of, like, Lifetime movie, but also a Mary Tyler Moore, like, girl in the city is going to make it on her own type of thing. And they rarely play a moment for just straight drama. Like, even when they deal with subjects that are very, very touchy, they find comedy in it. And comedy is almost a form of denial for that character. And I think they've really touched on that in interesting ways. But you're right, it's really tricky to strike the right balance.
And Jen, as we start to wrap up, are we seeing powerful women behind the scenes? Is that partly what's driving this, or are the characters on the screen allowing for more powerful women in scripting, directing, producing?
We're starting to see more of that, more women behind the scenes. You know, with a lot of the shows we're talking about, they sprang from female minds. Amy Sherman-Palladino created The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Marty Noxon is responsible for Dietland, and she also is the showrunner on Sharp Objects, which is adapted from Gillian Flynn's novel, and Gillian Flynn played a role in adapting it for series. But, you know, I think we still need to be seeing more female directors, more female showrunners. You know, you look at the Emmy nominations this year, for example, in the Best Drama category, and there's only one show, Westworld, that has a, you know, co-creator who's female, but every other show was created by a man. And I think that while there's been progress, there are still some barriers that need to be overcome in that regard, for sure.
Well, Jen, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
That was Jen Chaney, a pop culture writer and critic for Vulture. She joined us to look at the recent rise of television shows that feature female-driven narratives and protagonists. It's time for Food Friday. With summer in full swing, there's no better time to head to your favorite campsite for a day, a weekend, or maybe longer. But just because you're roughing it doesn't mean your meals should suffer. After all, why settle for hot dogs and marshmallows when you could have fire-cooked steak or tiramisu French toast? Emma Frisch is the co-founder and culinary director of Firelight Camps, a glamping destination in Ithaca, New York. Her new book is Feast by Firelight, simple recipes for camping, cabins, and the great outdoors. Emma, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Judah.
So, first of all, for people who don't know what glamping is, can you describe that for us?
Sure. Glamping is a word that is mashed up from glamorous and camping. And in the shortest sense, it's basically arriving at a campsite that's already set up for you. There's different levels of how well set up it is. For example, at Firelight Camps, which we have here in Ithaca, we have king and queen beds that are, you know, have plush bedding and fully furnished safari tents. And a full-service bar and other amenities for glampers to enjoy.
So more than roughing it, it's more like sleeping en plein air, maybe.
That's a good way to put it.
Well, of course, if you're going to, you know, kind of have that slightly more luxurious experience outdoors, it makes sense that the food that you would be making would be a step up, too. And so you make the case that camp cooking can and should be more than just roasting hot dogs and marshmallows over a fire. But you really love that over a fire part. What is it about cooking outdoors and eating outdoors that's so special for you?
Yeah, well, so my background is actually, I was trained as a backcountry guide, and I was a rock climber for years, and so I had this experience cooking in really rugged situations where often you just throw together a fire and put a grate over it or not, put something on a stick and cook it. And then, you know, fast forward now to this glamping scenario, which is an upscale camping experience, the fire still continues to be this place where no matter what, no matter where you come from or who you are or how you're getting outside, it just brings you back to this really primal state that's deep inside all of us. Because creating that campfire is an ancient human tradition. It's something that's unique to humans. And cooking over fire infuses the food with this taste of smoke that I think all of us have in our bones. And, you know, I've never met anyone who doesn't like something that's been smoked or grilled. So I think that's what it is for me. That's what really has drawn me in, is just seeing the ability to have people connect with themselves, each other, and nature, and the source of who we are and what we eat, which is, you know, this very special experience.
Well, and you say it's really an opportunity to fine-tune our senses when we're cooking and eating outdoors. Why do you think it has that ability?
Yeah, well, when we're cooking outdoors, we don't have gadgets and actually, I do recommend you make a thermometer for cooking meat, but it's not the same as cooking in an oven where you turn a dial or you sous vide and set a temperature and let it be. It's really about paying attention to what's happening to the cooking source. So the heat, even if you're using a camp stove, the heat will vary based on how much wind there is. Looking at, you know, how hot the fire is based on the color of the coals, using your hand to sense the heat of the fire by just holding it above. So, and your nose, I mean, there's one recipe for cornbread, which really the way that you know the cornbread is done in the Dutch oven is by smelling it. So you're so present and tuned into the process of cooking when you're cooking outside that I don't think happens when you're in the kitchen.
Obviously, camping can mean a whole lot of different things to different people. It might be a weekend at a local state park with small kids in tow, or it could be a week or more, you know, backpacking into the North Woods of Wisconsin. Do you find that your food approach varies based on the kind of trip you're taking and who you're going to be with?
Yes, I definitely think that the food approach will vary. And actually, in my book, there's menu planners in the back to help people and guide them towards what kind of weekend they're having. So if they're doing a backcountry trip and they want to pack really light, there's a menu for that. If it's with family and they're car camping, then there's a menu for that with kid-friendly recipes. So it definitely varies. And I think that's the trickiest part of cooking outside, is planning and packing. And so that's what I really try to do in this book, is set people up for success so that once they're outside, no matter what kind of trip, it'll be seamless and fun and feel like there's not a lot to do.
We're talking with Emma Frisch right now. She's the co-founder and culinary director of Firelight Camps. It's a glamping destination in Ithaca, New York. And we're talking about her new book, which is Feast by Firelight, Simple Recipes for Camping, Cabins, and the Great Outdoors. I think one of the challenges, Emma, is not just figuring out what you want to eat and bringing the actual food ingredients, but having the things you need to prepare them. And so what are some good lessons or tips or a checklist of what we should think about bringing with us so we can successfully cook the food that we brought?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I do have a section called the Essential Outdoor Kitchen, which lists all the different tools and servingware and pots and pans that people would need. Although what I really suggest is that people first choose their recipes and then determine what equipment they need for those recipes and then create their list. And often it's a lot smaller than what they think they need. So, and I'm a huge advocate of having of less is more, especially in the backcountry. But, you know, at its most basic, a good knife, tongs, a spatula, a grill grate if you don't have one or if there isn't one at the campground, and dishware. Because really, if you're preparing things in advance and you have it ready to go, you can just throw it on the grill and that's all you need.
And it seems like in our kitchens, not that I would be speaking about myself, of course, but there is an attraction to lots of gadgets. And it's fun to have the gadget that does exactly this one thing. And it's fun to use those. But it seems like the opposite would be true when you're packing up to do your cooking outdoors. You want tools, not gadgets, that actually maybe are multi-purpose and can be used in several different ways.
Definitely. I think part of, you know, especially with the camping world, there's so much consumerism around it. And I'm a total gear junkie, so I get it. It's fun to have the most up-to-date equipment and a great camp stove. But really, when you're outside, you don't really need new shiny things. You want to use things that are very functional and rugged and purposeful and, like you said, can serve multiple purposes. But there are, you know, there's a few things that are worth bringing. If you're cooking on a grill, then a charcoal chimney is a good idea. It's good to have a solid camp stove. So there's a few things that, you want to invest in, but other things like pots and pans. I mean, I have a cast iron that I've been using for 15 years that I bring. If people want to bring something that's lighter weight, they can bring the pan that is the most banged up in their kitchen because it'll probably get more banged up, and just use that.
It's Food Friday, and we're feasting by firelight with Emma Frisch. She's sharing some ideas for creating easy gourmet meals from the comfort of your campsite, whether you're deep in the backwoods or just in your backyard. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What kinds of meals do you make on camping trips? Do you have a go-to dish that blows away your fellow campers? How do you get your gourmet on when space and packing is at a premium? And do you prefer camp cooking on the grill or right over the fire? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. It's Food Friday, and we're talking this week about camp cooking with Emma Frisch. Emma's the author of Feast by Firelight, Simple Recipes for Camping, Cabins, and the Great Outdoors. And we want your recipes and questions, too. The number to call is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What dish just tastes better when it's cooked at a campsite? What are your camp cooking hacks, especially when you're packing light? And what does camp cooking mean to you? Is it more than just hot dogs and marshmallows, or are you fine with those standards? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Emma, you know, there are plenty of ways you can cook while camping. Some people like to bring their own propane grills or even a small charcoal grill. Others cook right on the campfire itself. Do you have a preferred method? What are the pros and cons?
It really varies where I am, but I think my preferred method is over the campfire because you can just do so much. You can have, you know, you can rake coals to one side and bake potatoes and foil right on the coals while on the other side, you're grilling steak or honey coriander pork chops over hotter flames. It sort of serves all those purposes, and you get that campfire feel where everyone's gathered around and cooking and celebrating together.
And one of the things you talk about is doing some prep work at home, and so taking things that are kind of halfway ready or ready to put on the fire. Zach on Facebook said he likes to find a good tortilla soup mix. Then he makes it extra thick and puts it on tortillas with cheese. So that's kind of that idea. You're starting with kind of a ready-made or partially made main ingredient.
Definitely. I'm a huge proponent of that. I love prepping at home, and it can be as simple as slicing vegetables and putting them in a Ziploc with olive oil, salt, and pepper. But that way you're not carting everything outside and spending that time prepping outside, and it's just ready to go. Especially because when you're outside, you're often hiking, canoeing, doing something active, and you're hungry. And, you know, the process of cooking can take a while when you're getting coals to light and doing all those things to set yourself up.
It's kind of the vacation equivalent of coming home after a long day of work and having to get dinner on the table.
Exactly. And of course, you should have some cheese and wine and beer and all that stuff ready to go while the zucchini's cooking or whatever you have. But yes, it is very much that approach.
Well, I want to talk about breakfast because I'm a huge breakfast fan, indoors, outdoors, anytime, anywhere. Dan on Facebook said he loves to grill meats over the fire using a tripod grill, and he also says that bacon, eggs, and sautéed veggies in an iron skillet are his breakfast favorites. And you have a lot of breakfast suggestions, and one that we have the recipe for up at wpr.org/foodfriday is tiramisu French toast with strawberries. I have to say, Emma, that is not something I think most people would think of as camp cooking. They would think of that as fancy brunch outing.
Definitely, yeah. And the picture in the book feels like fancy brunch outing too. So that one I had to put in because it's so easy. French toast in general is easy. And when you do it with a baguette, it absorbs all the liquid. So you don't end up with all this extra egg custard, and the tiramisu part is pre-whipped at home. It's basically espresso and honey and mascarpone, and you just put it back in the container that you bought it in and bring it in, you know, to your campsite with the bread and egg mixture, which you can make at home as well, and some fresh strawberries or freeze-dried strawberries if you don't have fresh ones, and put it together. So it's actually one of the easiest recipes, but it just feels so luxurious, especially for kids. And you can leave the espresso out of the topping as well if kids are eating it.
Wow. What are some of your other favorites? That sounds amazing. What about some egg dishes that might be a really great hearty protein-rich dish to get you started for an active day out in the woods?
Yeah, well, one of my favorites is very simple, which is bird in a nest. And people know it as toad in a hole and spit in the eye. But basically, you use a small mouth ball jar to cut a hole out of a beautiful slab of bread. And then you cook the egg inside that hole on a pan. And then I top it with avocado and honey, which is a really interesting combination. It's so good. We actually make this almost every morning for our family. My 2-year-old loves it. And for adults, we put some chili flakes on too, just to give it a little bit of pizzazz.
And you mentioned in the book, that just reminded me, that one of the great things about traveling somewhere and then camping is that on the way you can pick things up from either farm stands or local honey producers. And that's a really great way to get a very, very local taste.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and honey is such a great thing to have around, because I don't know about you, but my grandma was a believer in putting it on all scrapes and wounds, and you can even use it as a face mask, but it's also good for just boosting the immune system and fighting local allergies. So it's kind of like this cure-all food that you can keep in your kit.
Let's go to the phones, and Heather in Madison is up. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
Hi. What do you like to make when you're camping?
It has to do with eggs, too. We bring a cast iron skillet and cook eggs in purgatory, or it's called shakshuka, over the fire.
Oh, I love shakshuka.
Yeah. So we do, like, peppers and onions sautéed up to make it a little spicy, and then add in some tomato sauce, and then poach the eggs in it and serve with some grilled bread.
Oh, man. I bet you have people coming from campsites all around when they get a whiff of that.
My husband usually eats it pretty quickly, so I don't know if they
can. That sounds amazing.
Thanks for that call, Heather. And Emma, it seems like that would be a great one because the eggs are in that, you know, really great saucy kind of stew that even if the fire was maybe a little hotter or not as hot as you expected, it wouldn't have any kind of bad effect on it.
Exactly. And that you could even make for dinner. You could put it over rice or you know, any kind of grain. I mean, that's just such a great hearty dish.
Oh, I'm hungry now. Let's go next to Mark in Three Lakes. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to know if you guys know about keyhole fires.
I will defer to Emma on that. Emma, are you familiar with a keyhole fire?
Is that where there's a cross in a piece in a log that then you burn?
No, that's you make a keyhole, like the old skeleton key. You build your fire on the outside, and you put your cooking grate where the square notch is. You put your grate over it. This is what I use. I cook for like 14 people at a crack.
Wow.
So you got to keep the fire hot. And you got your fire going on one side, and you're cooking on the other side. And you rake the hot coals under your kettle in order to keep them warm, or cook your eggs or bacon or whatever you wish.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. That sounds amazing. I'd love to come eat with you at some point.
Well, and that, I mean, cooking for 14 people, that's a lot. You probably cook for large crowds pretty often too, huh, Emma?
I do, yeah. I'm actually pregnant with our second baby, so this summer I've taken a little bit of a pause. But, yeah, sometimes up to 30 people at our campsite.
Wow. I want to come to your campsite and have you cook for me.
We would love to have you visit.
Well, I don't want to let you go before we talk desserts. And, I think there's some really classic ones like cobblers cooked in a Dutch oven or a fire. Of course, there are s'mores. But what are some good sweet options to consider?
Ooh, well, one of my favorites, and this is top of mind right now because it's cherry season here in New York, is a cherry bourbon fool, which is basically whipped cream that you make by shaking the cream in a ball jar with a marble, or I just say a pebble that you can find and clean. And you shake it until it turns into cream. It's so fun, and kids love doing it too. And then you whip in some bourbon and cherries and a few other ingredients to make it sweet. And it's just, it's so, so good, so easy, so summer. And then, you know, there's other recipes for cooking over the campfire if you want to get more involved. But one of my favorites is the Molten Lava Campfire Brownies in Orange Cups, which is basically a brownie batter cooked in oranges that have been scooped out and then put back to get, sliced in half, scooped out, put back together and wrapped in foil, and then you put those in the coals.
Wow.
And you just eat it out with a spoon, and it's just, so good.
That sounds amazing. Well, on Facebook, Carol said she likes to make banana boats, and she says you make a slit on the inside curve of a banana. You stuff that with chocolate chips, mini marshmallows, and nuts. You wrap it in tinfoil, and then you set it at the edge of the fire or in the coals, as you were just saying with your orange chocolate brownies, until gooey, and eat with a spoon. And it seems like both of those have one of the great advantages of no dishes after.
Yep, that's the goal.
And what about, I mean, s'mores are great. You know, it's hard to mess with a classic, but are there ways to kind of fancy up or glamp up our s'mores?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, we have a yoga retreat at our glamp site at Firelight Camps this weekend, and they've been making, so we have homemade s'more kits that we offer, and there's sweet mint growing around one of the ponds on our site, and they've actually been putting the mint in with a s'more, so you get this like refreshing chocolate mint flavor. So I would say if anybody has mint leaves, they could just try adding a mint leaf into their s'more and see what that tastes like. But there's all sorts of, you know, you can put some like fresh preserves on a s'more to add some fruit to it, or fresh fruit, and just kind of kick it up a notch.
Wow, that sounds delicious. Well, Emma, it sounds like you have really gotten the camp cooking down, but I'm curious if there's a dish that you've really wanted to transform into a camping dish that just hasn't quite worked out the way you wish it would.
Mm-hmm. Well, those will probably be in the next book. but one recipe that I was so stuck on trying to create is a skewer that has chicken and pineapple on it, because the combo of pineapple and grilled chicken is incredible, except that pineapple breaks down chicken when it touches chicken.
Oh, because it's so acidic?
Exactly, yeah. And it's just this weird texture. So I did a million different kinds of tests to see how we could make that work, and I haven't quite nailed it. But at some point, there will be grilled pineapple and grilled chicken together in one dish over the campfire.
well, we'll follow along and see if that works. So you do most of your work at your business in Ithaca, New York, but do you ever take it on the road?
I do sometimes, yeah. I mostly, you know, for cooking with friends and getaways, and sometimes doing small events or live cooking demos at festivals.
Great.
This month we'll be doing a feast from the book at a cider house here in Ithaca, which is this beautiful setting overlooking a huge lake, and it'll be a multi-course experience taking people through the book, and they'll actually be eating around the campfire as well.
Wow. Well, maybe you can bring it to Wisconsin sometime.
That would be so fun. I'd love to visit.
Well, Emma, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Emma Frisch is the co-founder and culinary director of Firelight Camps. It's a glamping destination in Ithaca, New York. Her new book is Feast by Firelight, Simple Recipes for Camping, Cabins, and the Great Outdoors. You can find the recipes we talked about today, including tiramisu French toast and also a fire-licked skirt steak with salsa verde, on WPR.org. Forty-nine years ago today, the world heard this.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The Apollo 11 mission had launched 4 days earlier from Cape Kennedy. Commander Neil Armstrong, Command Module Pilot Michael Collins, and Lunar Module Pilot Edwin Buzz Aldrin were aboard. On July 20th, Armstrong and Aldrin set off for the moon's surface in the Lunar Module Eagle, and Armstrong was the first to set foot on the surface of the moon. They say that as many as 530 million people watched the televised moon landing. That's out of a 1969 world population of just a little over 3.5 billion. I've seen lots of people posting on social media about where they were and what they remember from that day. I can't really say I remember where I was, but I do have a photo to rely on. I was 2.5 at the time, and we lived in an apartment on Racine Avenue in Chicago. My parents put me next to our small TV and took my picture as Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon. I look a little confused since I wasn't sure why I was standing there, but it's a pretty cool photo to have. If you remember where you were at the time, tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then in our weekly look at top state news stories, we'll take a look at fundraising reports filed this week by candidates for governor. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.